Welcome to the Solve the Overeating Puzzle podcast. I'm your host, Eugenia Nikiforo, and the founder of Unlocks You, the Eating Psychology Clinic. I'm passionate about bringing psychology, nutrition, and neuroscience together to dive deep into the underlying and often hidden reasons for our food cravings, overeating, and binge eating urges. We are all unique and have to consider who we are as an eater. Therefore, I really believe we identify what is contributing to our relationship with food, we know which specific keys to use to unlock that transformation we so desire. In this podcast, I am aiming to give you the insights into psychology and brain so you understand why you eat the way you do and know how to apply this knowledge in your daily life so you can eat, live, feel, and be exactly the way you desire and deserve. In this episode, I'm talking to Kirsty, our clinical nutritionist who's specializing on gut health and women's hormones. Kirsty works with women healing their gut, period, PMS, PCOS, endometriosis, perimenopause, and menopause. She also focuses on infertility, pre-postnatal nutrition, and pregnancy. I feel very, very honored talking to Kirsty today about bariatric surgery and everything that we need to know about it, whether you have undergone the surgery or are considering to do that. If you have undergone the bariatric surgery, in this episode, you will learn what to focus on for optimum results and ongoing great health. If you're considering getting it done, there's everything you need to know so you can make an informed decision. In this episode, we talk about who might be eligible for the surgery, how to optimize brain and gut health after the surgery, and why it's so important to prioritize that, what, how much, and when to eat to keep your metabolic health at optimum for long-term weight management, which nutrients to focus on and why it is so important, and the type of tests you can do to avoid nutrient deficiency long-term. Let's get started. Hello, Kirsty.
Hi, how are you?
I am very good. Thank you so much for joining me today for this, I really believe, absolutely important conversation about bariatric surgery. And I want this conversation to be for everyone and anyone who maybe has had the surgery or is considering having a bariatric surgery. You and I have been working together for a while, and we have seen quite a few clients who have had the surgery or were considering one and chose not to go for it. But something that I've been seeing over and over and over again when it comes to bariatric surgeries, I've had clients who have had one long time ago, and they have regained, they lost 30 kgs, they have regained the 30 kgs back. Some of our clients have lost a lot of weight, unfortunately started regaining the weight back, and also noticed particularly that their old eating habits actually started returning as well. So they started working with us to really work on those behaviors around food and the habits and the mindset around food. And we've had clients who, yeah, like I said, were considering one and actually said, no, I would like to work on my behaviors and the psychology around food, and chose not to go for the surgery. But today I really want this conversation to be for anyone who is maybe considering it or has had one. So we kind of really talk about what do they need to consider? What is it that they need to know about when it comes to nutrition, mood, and so much more. So I'm really looking forward to the conversation with you today.
Yeah, me too. I can't wait to crack into it. It's going to be very interesting to unpack together.
Let's do it. Yes, absolutely. So like I said, we do have quite a few clients who have had the surgery. What do you see personally is the main reason why someone might consider one?
That's a really great question to kick us off. Yeah, so I suppose first and foremost, obesity from a medical perspective, so what the medical establishment label as someone that is has a BMI of 35 and over, is a multifactorial disease, right? So meaning it can be brought on by many, many different parts of the picture. It isn't just about a person eating too much or exercising too little. It could be things like the medications that they're on, endocrine system disruption, so the hormones, their environment. So let's say your family is eating really badly, then you're way more likely to follow suit. It could be cognitive neurobehavioral, so addictive behaviors or craving that dopamine hit because your neurotransmitter creation is compromised, for example. Their immunity also plays a role, so meaning deficiency in vitamins and minerals. Even our genetics and our epigenetics can play a role. So sometimes it's some of these and sometimes it's all of these, but the main takeaway is that it's a multifactorial disease and it's far more nuanced than, like I said, you're just eating too much and not exercising enough. So when approaching obesity, as a registered clinical nutritionist, I have to think about the whole picture of the person. But I also believe wholeheartedly in the philosophies of Hippocrates and Edison, which are let food be thy medicine and thy medicine be thy food. And the doctor of the future will give no medication, but will interest his patients in the care of the human frame, diet, and in the cause and prevention of disease. So my protocols usually start with a food first approach, focusing on eating a whole foods diet, restoring gut health, and removing inflammatory agents like gluten and dairy from the diet, whilst also working on other parts of the picture that might be playing a role, like the ones that I talked about above. And that's through things like diagnostic testing, supplementation, and lifestyle changes. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I really love what you're saying, and that's why we're working together, because my approach is really very much aligned with what you're saying. And that's what we do at Unlocks You. When we start working with clients, our first approach is actually really looking at the diet and what they eat, how much they eat, when they eat, because from what we know, food really can impact our gut bacteria, right? Our gut bacteria can impact our mood. Mood can, or sort of dopamine receptors. If all of that is not working, that will drive us to eat just to make ourselves feel good. But obviously we know it's only short lived. So it's that cycle continues. And obviously, again, not only our gut bacteria, it's also it impacts our hormones and also further food choices and just so much more. So I absolutely agree with you. I think the first really approach is to look into the diet and let nutrition really be part of our healing.
Yeah, 100%. So just as an aside, anyone that is considering a bariatric surgery of any kind, your BMI needs to be 35 and over, and have comorbidities attached to that, like type 2 diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, etc. That's just a consideration. It's not an elective surgery. It's something that is done mechanistically to try and improve health outcomes overall.
All right. So we just mentioned mood, All right. Mm. So what we know, our gut bacteria or our gut is really very much connected with our brain. And depending on our gut bacteria, it might impact our mood and how we feel. It might impact depression and anxiety from what we know. So there's a strong correlation really between gut and brain. So how do you know, what have you seen? How does gastric bypass surgery impact mental health?
Yeah, so in the book, Galliford, Charlton and Booth, Costs and Outcomes of Increasing Access to Bariatric Surgery for Obesity, Chapter 9 quotes, patients under bariatric surgery have higher levels of depression than other obese patients with similar BMI of the same age and sex. So put simply, a combination of a lack of vital nutrients, stress from the operation, as well as inflammation, both the new inflammation from the op that they've had and pre-existing inflammation, so the inflammation that drove them to have the op in the first place, can affect neurotransmitter creation. Do you need me to repeat that and break it down, or did you get that?
I think it would be great to, yeah, repeat it, but more so break down so everyone who is listening can really understand well. And again, because for me, this conversation is really important for everyone who even maybe is considering it, so they can make an informed decision whether that's something that they want to do.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so put simply, a combination of lack in vital nutrients. So that's a lack in vitamins and minerals, and the stress, which obviously wreaks havoc in your body anyway, not only stress from your lifestyle factors, but stress from the operation, physical stress, and emotional, psychological stress, as well as underlying inflammation that caused you to have. So obesity is an inflammatory disease, as well as, you know, all those other things that I talked about before. And on top of that, the new inflammation from the surgery itself can affect neurotransmitter creation. So I'll go into a little bit more of that when we get further down in the questions about how that works mechanistically. But it's really just super important after the operation to focus on healing the gut and gut health, and also focus on vitamin and mineral repletion through supplementation, as well as a whole foods diet. With adequate protein and enough calories, which is half the problem with these surgeries, is you go from having a bag, you know, which is the stomach, to a pipe, which means that physically you can't handle the amount of calories that you once did, which is really your basal metabolic rate. So all of us, depending on our size, both height and weight, have a baseline caloric requirement in order for our organs, just our basic human function, to happen. And post-surgery, often patients will fall short of that caloric requirement over an extended period of time, meaning their basic nutrients just aren't being met.
Okay, because they naturally are eating less, obviously.
Much, much less. Yeah. I mean, I've got clients that really should be eating 1500 calories that fall into an extended period of eating 800 calories. And if you really want to think about it from a sort of medical standpoint, then that then leads them into what is classed as anorexia, because they're falling short of that caloric requirement over that extended period of time.
A question that I was asked actually just recently from a client who's undergone the surgery, and she asked me if I am falling so short on calories and I'm under eating that way, let's say 800 calories, is this going to impact the metabolism long term?
Yeah, 100% it will. Just as an anorexic, and I don't mean to keep classing it as that, but if you imagine over an extended period of time being in that sense of lack, not only are you vitamin and mineral depleted, but you're also telling the body, you're in a state of starvation, right? So what does that do? That down regulates your hormones, because it's not, you're telling your body it's not safe to procreate. So there goes estrogen, there goes your period, as well as, you know, your neurotransmitters simply don't have enough vital nutrients to produce. So then you fall into a state of depression. And there's certainly other symptoms that come as a result of that, hair falling out, potentially thyroid issues. And then when you do start to, if you do start to replete, if you do start to add in calories, your body is still in that state of starvation. So it goes, you know what, we've got to hold on to this. We've got to hold on to this for who knows how long, because we don't know when we're going to get this next meal.
Mm. So this is someone who wants to lose weight, body fat, right? Mm-hmm. Specifically, who wants to lose body fat. They, however, because of the low amount of calories, their body goes into that starvation mode. So at some point, we can assume the weight or the fat loss will pause, right? Will stop. So what do you suggest for that person to do then?
That person needs to have a consistent effort of eating to caloric requirement of that BMR, which is your basal metabolic rate, as discussed before. So you need to tell your body again that it's safe. And I suppose because clients have had bariatric surgeries mechanistically can't handle the amount of food that you and I would handle, i.e. three larger meals throughout the day, or three meals and two snacks, you know, just dependent on what you enjoy and your exercise, then we need to break it down for them in a way that they're going to be able to handle enough. So for example, if it was three big meals a day for you and I, a post-bariatric surgery client might look to have five smaller meals in a day, which could look like 250 to 300 calories. Now, I don't normally count calories with clients. I usually use a hand method to give them an idea of how much should be on their plate. But certainly the amount that would be on a plate for you and I would have to be halved and then spread over multiple times during the day rather than three large meals. Does that make sense?
Mm, yes, absolutely. So eating more frequently to Correct. Make sure that they're eating enough calories. So I know we, and you and I, we're both not we don't really talk about calories, but if there was then a number that you could throw, let's say, out there, if you feel comfortable with it, how much should someone aim for after the surgery to make sure that their metabolism is actually healthy?
Oh, how long's the piece of string? it is totally dependent on the individual. You might have someone, a guy that's 6'3" and 150 kgs, his basal metabolic rate, and let's say, you know, he's a tradie and he works all day, so the exercise on top of that is also burning calories, his basal metabolic rate is going to be double that of a 5'1", 50, you know, well, let's not say 50 because that would be inappropriate for bariatric surgery, but let's say in a 50 a 5'1" and 80 90 kg woman, for example, so she is going to be much different basal metabolic rate and caloric requirement than someone that's, you know, doing way more and also very, very large in terms of height and weight.
Mm, that makes sense. So really kind of every person has to work with their own requirements, and also considering gender, height, daily activity levels as well.
Very much so. Yeah, daily activity levels play a huge role. So you can't just eat based on doing a calculation on the internet. You need to take into account how much exercise you're doing and add in those calories to account for that extra exercise.
So I think something really that is quite important, if that's not explained, when someone is considering the surgery, because I personally, I do need to say, I don't know what those consultation entail and what's really kind of part of that as well. But I think really important to consider while you're losing weight, and if your calories are just too low, that will create further problems long term, metabolism wise, and might stall the fat loss later on. And let's say because my metabolism just has adjusted to that low amount just to maintain that weight, then after the fat loss, that amount will be just very, very low. Right.
Yeah. So like if you have been in a state of eating, let's say 800, because you just can't fit it in, or you're not quite sure how to eat post-surgery, then you do need to go on a little bit of a journey of refeeding. Like you wouldn't just go, let's say someone's falling short 700 calories of the goal. You wouldn't just smack them straight on 1500 calories from 8. You would incrementally titrate up the calories so that they didn't go into dumping syndrome, which is something that I can discuss, but also they don't freak out, their body doesn't, you know, start holding on to the weight like no tomorrow. It's just a gradual adaptation.
Yes, reverse dieting is a key word here as well, right?
There you go. That's the word I was looking for.
Yes, reverse dieting. We know about reverse diet. Well, let's say specifically in the muscle building and bodybuilding and body physique industry. I think it's a big word, reverse dieting. So what we mean by that is that we slowly increase the daily calories and then keep that amount of calories that we increase by for a week or two, and then increase it one more time. So very slowly, like refeeding the body without that it kind of goes into and stores all the body fat immediately.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Okay, so really, really fascinating and interesting. So let's continue talking about food. We talked a little bit about how much, I guess, and how often to eat. So what would you say, what is it that people need to focus on when it comes to what to eat?
That's a great question. So with what they need to be eating, again, first and foremost, they need to be having a whole foods diet and taking out inflammatory agents that could be further exacerbating gut issues. So I'll start off with protein. So I guess if you want to think about protein and the purpose of it, protein is the building blocks of the body. So literally builds structure. And fat's really important as well, to make sure that neurotransmitter creation is sufficient, but also making sure that the fat soluble vitamins are taken care of and healthy hormone creation is taken care of. And that's all created by healthy fats. So fats create structure, and they also fuel for the body. If you want to think about people that are on like a ketogenic diet, for example, and just making sure that they're getting enough carbohydrate by way of about a fistful of carbohydrates is what I like to use. Your hands are really good example for you and I to eat. Maybe someone that's post bariatric surgery would want to half that, like I said, with the 5 or 6 meals a day. But certainly when we're putting a plate together, we want to be thinking about prioritizing protein, as protein is that structural building block. So for example, a breakfast could be a smoothie with 20 grams of protein, if they can get it all in. I know some of my clients find it hard to even have a full smoothie, but then they could come back to it at 10:30, let's say. And then same with lunch. Like a good example is create a meal like they would for their partner, obviously proportionate to their hand, but they could half it, so they could have half of that for lunch at 1 and then the other half at 3:30, and same deal for dinner. Or if they like a sweet treat to finish their evening, they could work on like a healthful high protein snack that they can have just before bed. that is really just going after nutrient sufficiency. I went off on a tangent there. Sorry, what was your question?
I was asking what they need to focus on, so what to eat. And you did mention talk about protein, so really making sure that they have protein with really every of their meal and focus on getting enough protein through the day.
Yeah, 100%. That is the kingpin macronutrient, but they also really need to focus on fiber, just to help with that motility and binding to excess hormones, and just moving through stuff through the stomach, but also making sure that their vitamin and mineral stores are keeping up as much as possible. Because if we want to think about how deficiencies are created, so we absorb nutrients from our food through our digestive tract, right? This is where the magic happens. So in terms of absorption of vitamins and minerals, we have through the gastric bypass sections of the tract, like the stomach, the duodenum, the jejunum, they're all removed. So this limits then the size of the surface area of how and where the stomach can actually absorb those vital nutrients. Our bodies are amazing at adapting, but we need to make sure that we're supplementing some of those vitamins and minerals, as well as trying to eat a decent chunk of fruits and vegetables, so there's an abundance of those nutrients that can be absorbed in other areas of the gut and digestive tract.
So making sure that they're eating enough, like we talked about, focus on good and healthy fats, protein, and definitely supplements, because their surface area of their stomach has been reduced and therefore the absorption is now minimized.
Yeah. And certainly mechanistically, if you want to think about the stomach and the duodenum and jejunum, that's where a lot of those vitamins and minerals are actually absorbed. So we've taken quite a crucial part of the stomach out. So that's why we need a supplement. I would put anyone that's post-bariatric surgery on supplements, just to as an insurance policy, to make sure that their vitamin and mineral stores are repleting post-surgery.
What typical supplements do you prescribe? So which vitamins and minerals do you feel that most people need?
Yeah, well, that's a really great question. It does depend on the person as well. So that comes back to that symptomatology. What is the person displaying in terms of their symptoms? But for an example, B1 is something that is affected by the surgery. So decreased acid production, it's not able to absorb. Sorry, I'm trying to find the right words here. B12 is also compromised. Folate can be compromised. Calcium, vitamin D, certainly those fat-soluble vitamins, A, E, K, iron, and zinc, because of the body's limited storage. So I guess the first port of call would be to put them on a multi-nutrient supplement, just to start the process. I also find that because mechanistically the stomach has been altered, so the process of digestion from the esophagus down into the stomach has been altered, the ability to be able to break down through gastric juices and acids has been impacted. So certainly a digestive enzyme is really important as well. And then a lot of these people are having trouble sleeping. So magnesium is something that I really like to lean on as well, to help with sleep, and also probiotics containing like lactobacillus, bifidobacterium, saccharomyces are all really great for strengthening the gut wall.
Awesome. Great. Okay. And in terms of protein, I guess my question is, maybe the answer might also be, it depends, but I still wanted to see if we can get more details here for those who ask maybe, well, what does it mean enough protein? Make sure you get enough and good amount of protein. How much would that be? What does someone need to, what is it that they need to aim for?
That's a really great question. Again, depending on the individual, but it's more dependent on the individual from a standpoint of how much activity are they doing. So as a baseline, like let's draw a line in the sand and give a calculation, I would like to see someone on 1.4 grams per kg of body weight. Mm-hmm. And then if they are exercising or if they are doing heavy activities and they're quite active during the day, then that does start to increase to 1.5, 1.6, right up to 2 grams of protein per kg of body weight. And then if you really are having trouble with like binge eating or insulin resistance or blood sugar, trying to stabilize blood sugars, then you would start to try titrate up protein again, because blood sugar, protein is incredibly satiating, as well as looking at making sure you're getting enough healthy fats and titrating down carbohydrates. So you play around with protein and fat and you drop carbohydrates to stabilize blood sugars and keep someone satiated. And once they reach a little bit more metabolic flexibility and their blood sugars are a lot more stable, then you can introduce carbohydrate to what's called tolerance level, which is at the point where someone is really happy, really satiated, and doesn't have any blood sugar dismanagement or symptomatology.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's say if someone is 80 kilograms and like you're suggesting maybe 1.5 per kg, so it would be around 120 grams of protein per day.
Yeah, and if you really wanted to like think about what that looks like, so 1.5 is actually quite high if you think about it, because 3 eggs is 20 grams, right? So a lot of women that I see are eating like 1 egg, you know, as part of their meal, or they're eating a small little can of tuna. And like net protein level, because we always talk net when we're talking protein requirements, that's just simply not enough, A, to keep you satiated, B, to build the structure of the body, but mechanistically, yeah, just grow and build, and for DNA expression and certainly caloric requirement overall. So you probably will find if you're not getting that protein or enough of that protein, you are way more susceptible to binge eating because of that lack in satiation.
Binge eating, food cravings, those overeating urges as well. So I've just actually divided it into, so if we're thinking, we're just going to stay with that example, someone is around 80 kgs and we're considering we just stay with 1.5 per kgs, so it's 120 grams for the day. And it can be quite hard to actually get that amount, because I've just divided it by 3 and we get 40 grams. If let's say someone has all 3 main meals, that would be 40 grams. Let's say someone has had the surgery, so they can't have 3 main meals, so they need to divide it into smaller, let's say 6. So if they have 6 smaller meals, they would need to have around 20 grams of protein with every meal.
Correct. Yeah. So that would look like a protein shake. A couple of eggs, maybe 3 eggs, or 2 eggs, and some hummus or something on crackers, you know, as a snack. And then your meat, your whole foods type lunch, both at your lunchtime and then snack time, because you'd want to half that lunch. And the same again for dinner, and potentially a protein shake after that. So it does start to get quite cumbersome when you have to split off meals, going from what you ate pre-surgery, three larger meals and 2 snacks. And then mechanistically you have to switch to 6 smaller meals a day. Like it's frustrating and it's annoying. But it's really the only way that we can get someone back. And to be honest, I get clients that their BMR is, let's say, 1500, for example, but we can only take them up at this point in time to 1200 calories, because they physically can't handle the amount of food that is required for their basal metabolic rate. So near enough is good enough. Near enough is better than where they're at when they first come to see me.
So would you say to be able to get enough calories, sometimes we need to look into calorie density, so choose for foods that have more calories, so let's say like healthy fats?
Yeah, absolutely. But also you've got to remember that healthy fats are incredibly satiating when paired with protein, right? So it's a fine line between the building blocks of the body and making sure that if we feed them too much in the front half of the day, they're naturally going to downregulate their calorie consumption in the evening. So it's like, oh, do I put this person on more carbohydrate specifically because I want them to eat more? Or yeah, we just find balance it, and we have to keep playing around until we try and get near enough to that BMR that's going to support protein sufficiency, calorie sufficiency, and nutrient sufficiency overall.
Fascinating. Amazing. Good. Yeah. So basically from also the way I do it when working with clients, and I think that's what you're saying as well, let's start with protein. So when we're building our meals, let's prioritize protein. So we get, let's say 100 grams of chicken is around 30 grams of protein, which is amazing because that way we're covering quite a lot here already. So let's say 100 grams of chicken, and then we add the fats and then fiber as well, like obviously our greens or vegetables or salad, and then we add the rest will be then carbohydrates. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. And then there is a playing around over the period of the program to try and get them as close to that BMR as we can.
Okay, you also talked about gut health, so can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I can, absolutely. From what perspective do you want me to talk about that? So I talked about it from protein perspective. I've mentioned probiotics, but I suppose if you want to think about it from a surgical perspective, and to give you an analogy, it's like picking up a house, shaking it, and then dropping it back down and expecting all the furniture to be in the same place. Like, that just doesn't happen. There's an increased risk of SIBO post-surgery. So that's that bloating. Do you get bloating after meal? You're fine in the morning, and then it gets worse throughout the day. So SIBO is the small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, usually starts when your small intestines don't move food along the way it should. So bacteria grow and stick around too long. So that's when we really need to take a look at microbial balance. We need to have a look at the lifestyle and environmental factors, what implications of what surgery they've had. And we need to just make sure that they don't have any medical issues as a result of the surgery. So I guess probiotics, making sure gut health is in line, and we're really focusing on gut health, but also things like making sure that you've got stress management techniques, because stress can really do a number on your gut, as well as making sure sleep hygiene is optimal. You know, you need to be sleeping like a champion. Yes. Just for healing purposes. Yeah.
Okay. So basically, and that was my question in terms of gut health. So if someone is maybe struggling with bloating and gas and just notices, oh, it's actually not really, I'm not eliminating food in the way, you know, everything that's left over on a regular basis, which is actually what you are suggesting, about every 12 hours. Is that right?
To 12 to 24 hours. And if anyone's seen the Bristol stool chart, then we want to be around a 3 or a 4. So that's to give you a really nice visual to start your day whenever you're listening to this, a really nice log shape rather than pebbles or diarrhea or loose stools.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so make sure you check it out.
You're like, yeah, I don't know where to take this conversation from there.
Oh, I can talk about that. Okay, which is actually really interesting, because that's something that I do talk about very easily, and sometimes other people usually respond,
Do you want me to do it? I'm like, I don't have a problem. If your stool is not healthy, it's a good indicator something is going on.
100%. Yeah. Right? So certainly during the coursework that we do with clients, I actually pull up the Bristol stool chart, and it is a topic of conversation, especially if it's a problem area of constipation and then diarrhea or one or the other. Then it's something that we revisit quite regularly and actually do a happy dance when the stools hit that log, you know, beautiful log, no straining. It's just a really nice feeling for a complete emptying.
That's right. And that complete emptying. I just recently I was listening to someone's podcast and I was reading a book, and it was this conversation about this complete emptying. So if there is a feeling like, okay, I've been to the toilet, but it seems like there is still something. Again, there is a problem.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. So that could be a lack of water. So you're not getting enough water, not getting enough fiber. It could be a whole lot of different things. It could be an allergen of some description. Usually if it is an allergen, though, you're more prone to diarrhea. Certainly dairy does cause loose stools and diarrhea, but if it's an issue, then we're always going to address it in our coursework, and there is further testing that we can do if that continues to be an issue.
So if we want to work on someone, let's say, is noticing these symptoms, and I know that you've mentioned a few things, but let's kind of like summarize that. What are the things that they can do to work on their gut health?
So first and foremost is probably slowing down and making sure that you're actually being mindful in your eating and you're chewing properly, not just wolfing it down, you know, in the car or bit distracted by your phone or TV or whatever, because digestion does start in the mouth and it's a full sensory experience. So when you're cooking and you smell the food, when you taste the food, salivary amylase starts and the digestive process starts in the mouth and makes its way through down to the digestive system. So even if at the very point of you eating and not chewing properly, you're going to have problems all along the way with absorption. Not to disregard the fact that bariatric surgery clients do have impacted absorption, or at least a reduced ability to be able to absorb due to the mechanistic changes from the operation. So need to be mindful, and you need to be not stressed when you're eating. So that's helpful. And then just making sure, like I said, with the whole foods framework, you're eating enough fiber and you're getting at least 2 liters of water a day and 1 extra liter of water for every hour of exercise.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then supplements if needed.
Definitely we can do supplements, we can do probiotics, we can do fiber supplements if needed, but generally I find just the whole foods framework is enough, and making sure those inflammatory gluten and dairy are out of the diet usually sorts a lot of those issues out.
All right, so we talked about what to eat, when to eat, how much to eat. That's amazing. Anything sort of else you want to add in terms of what nutrients someone needs to cover after the surgery?
Well, there are other things that we can add in for sure. So blood sugar balancing, we can add in inositol. So sort of works like B vitamins to stabilize the insulin response. We can add in fish oil, which is anti-inflammatory. It's helpful for hormones. It's helpful for neurotransmitter creation and just the brain. We can certainly add in, like I said, with the magnesium if sleep continues to be an issue. But we can also add in 5-HTP or L-theanine to help with sleep. If inflammation as a whole is part of the picture, and it usually is because of the op and like I said before, the other issues that make up the obesity picture, then we can add in anti-inflammatory supplements like curcumin and again the fish oil and others to help with that inflammatory response and bringing down that inflammation.
Okay, great. Yeah. You mentioned testing. a few times, also at the beginning, but also a few times. Can you talk more about testing? So what tests are available out there?
Yeah, so usually as part of the program, we usually do blood testing. So baseline bloods are always done just to see if we can pick up any subclinical deficiencies. So that then gets retested at the end of the program or halfway through, depending on what I'm working with the client and what I'm just trying to monitor. But we can do gut testing as well. So I have ability to be able to run organic acid tests, which is a urine test analysis that's done at home, sent to Napier and sent over to the States for analysis. So it's a comprehensive metabolic snapshot of the patient's health. It's got 76 different markers in it, so it is really comprehensive. Provides an accurate evaluation of intestinal yeast and bacteria. So abnormally high levels of these microorganisms can cause a worsening behavior in behavior disorders, hyperactivity, movement disorders, fatigue, and immune function. So many people with chronic illnesses and neurological disorders often excrete several abnormal organic acids in their urine. And then if we go into the interpretation, what I'd normally see is low B vitamins, low metabolites, especially L-carnitine, so energy producing molecules, lower magnesium, and looking to supplement, like I said, with things like magnesium, inositol, carnitine, B complex, iron. If it's an issue, I often see low iron and anemia in some clients as well.
And I think so important to actually get those tests done. I do think symptoms are great, and obviously our body is telling us when something is wrong, but I think in addition to symptoms, really good to get a test done, because then we have actual data we can work with and can be quite specific about what is it that we're targeting and which supplements, for example, to add as well, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So it's not just that, it does pick up things like fungal stuff. So if you have a lurking candida overgrowth, it can pick up heavy metal toxicity. So if you've got mercury fillings, for example, that could be exacerbating some of the symptoms that you're experiencing. Things like herbicides and pesticides get picked up. So if there's, Roundup being used outside, that could be collecting in your cells, or whatever else environmental toxic wise are ending up in your cells will get picked up by one of those reports. So it's just fascinating stuff once you get the interpretation, because sometimes it's not what you think it is that's causing the issues.
Okay, great. Okay, so what's your personal opinion, I guess, about the surgery? Get it done or not?
I would say, look, if it comes down to, imminent health issues, then there's definitely a need to get it done. So I'm certainly an advocate for medical interventions as and when it's necessary. I suppose the issue that I have is sometimes that is the first port of call rather than the ambulance at the end of the cliff. So hey, it's not working properly, so let's rip it out. And I feel like there is just so much that happens after the surgery in terms of implication to the person's life. So then they have to start eating, these six meals a day. They can't enjoy their social life as they once did. There's a whole lot more considerations in their vitamins and their minerals that they need to take on a daily basis. None of that really gets discussed or thought about like prior to the surgery happening. It's all stuff that they find out well after, and usually as a result of having suffered through the symptoms. What I would really love is for anyone that's considering the surgery to understand the full implications of the surgery and make this decision based on an educated understanding of what the implications are post-surgery, because surgery is just one day and then everything else happens afterwards.
Absolutely. And that's why it was so important for me to have this conversation, and also knowing this is not the solution. It's part of the puzzle. It's just one piece of the puzzle. Getting that surgery done, it is a small and kind of big step when it comes to our body. But then the work comes afterwards as well. And while the body is adjusting, now it's time to work on our psychology, right? That's where we now need to look into our habits and our behavior, stress management, sleep. How do we eat? When do we eat? Do I eat food for comfort, for stress, or is it, do I have bad habits that I've created over so many years that I need to now unlearn, to relearn new things, new behaviors, new habits, healthy habits for a long term? So I think it is really that first piece of a puzzle, and then the actual work that will continue afterwards.
100%. Yeah. And if I can wrap it up in a nice little bow for your clients that are listening to this, or anyone who's listening to this. So the summary of the patient priorities are gut health. You need to, number one, focus on gut health, focus on nutrient sufficiency, calorie sufficiency, and protein sufficiency. Really, really make sure sleep hygiene is of the utmost importance. So, you know, even the way that you lead yourself into bed at night, so that you're not having disrupted sleep, because sleep is incredibly healing, and making sure your stress management techniques, as all of us should, are also dialed in. So that's things like breathing and meditation, grounding, whatever ways that you can find that that just limit the amount of stress that you're carrying every day. And then from a more clinical perspective, surgery results in complex anatomical changes and physiological changes. So supplements need to be considered on a case-by-case basis, and personalizing supplements based on examining if their hair is shedding, micronutrient testing, blood testing, or gut testing, that's all of the utmost importance and done on a case-by-case basis.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much. Really fascinating. And I think so, so, so important, because obviously what we have seen with so many clients that we've been working with, that this information wasn't there. And they discovered only afterwards. It's really, I think, really important. So if people want to find you somewhere where they can follow you online, where are they going to find you?
Yeah, thanks. So they can find me on all my socials, Legacy Nutrition. I think it's _NZ for Instagram, and just Legacy Nutrition. That's my website. That's my Facebook. And I hang out with Eugenia over at Unlocks You as well. So you can find me there too.
Yes, absolutely. I will add your links in the description. And yes, Kirsty is our clinical nutritionist who helps our clients who want to focus on gut bacteria and also hormone health as well. Yeah. So yeah, we're working together there and helping everyone to really regain their health back.
Perfect.
Thank you so much for your time and this really amazing and important conversation. And we will talk soon again.
Thank you. Talk soon.